This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS radio every Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our website at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to our past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. Well, you can also listen to us via satellite on your Nokia phones. The details are on the website. Please visit us there, and you'll find out all the details. We have a fascinating return guest tonight. I really am excited about this. We have interviewed both the producer and the director of a film called Bloodline that has just had some incredibly rave reviews. Tonight we have with us Renee Barnett. I'm sorry, I dropped something here. Who is a former print journalist, a radio broadcaster, and television producer that worked on an incredible number of shows, Sci-Fi Channel, HBO, all of the greats. But in 2001, Bruce Burgess and Renee Barnett formed the Blue Book Films Incorporated. It's a Los Angeles-based documentary specializing in certain types of films. And one of the films that they have come up with was a fascinating independent feature documentary called Bloodline. Now, this Bloodline, first of all, welcome, Renee. Welcome back. We're thrilled.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
And I understand Bruce is dealing with a family emergency, and our good thoughts and good energies go out to him and his family.
Great. He appreciates that.
Wonderful. Tell us, how has Bloodline been received? The last time we spoke to you and Bruce, you were in the middle. This was just before it was going to be featured in theaters, and we just have been so anxious to find out some of the things that have happened since we've last had you on our show. How was the premiere?
Oh, it was amazing. We were so pleased, and I tell you, we weren't prepared really for the response that we were going to get from the audience in New York and since then here in Los Angeles. But we were so pleased, and the film, it seemed to be touching people in a way that we just never imagined that it would. I mean, we knew that we really were into the subject matter, and we were excited about the film ourselves, but, you know, until you put it out there, you just don't know how other people are going to react to it. And we were frankly stunned. People came up to us. We've been doing a lot of Q&As after the features, and people would come up and just hug us and thank us and just be overjoyed to have seen the movie and felt that it was part of, you know, some sort of activation of some kind on the planet, which we were just amazed. You know, we said we're just obviously vessels for this process then, because we had no idea. We don't consider ourselves anything special. Just filmmakers and journalists and people who are very interested in the truth.
Renee, can you do our new listeners a favor and please give us a short synopsis of Bloodline and in the making of it?
Sure. Bloodline is an investigative documentary, and when we started out, we had the idea to take the beginning of the Da Vinci Code, where Dan Brown sets out certain facts, And one of those is about the secret society called the Priory of Zion, the fact that it does and has existed for centuries and centuries, and the fact that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. So we said, well, let's see if there's any evidence to support these so-called facts of Dan Brown's. And I've been interested in the subject matter since 1982 when Holy Blood, Holy Grail was released and first kind of set out in the public consciousness this idea about Jesus and Mary Magdalene being married, and brought to the attention of the world that, you know, Mary Magdalene, some of her true history, that she was not a prostitute. While that had already been conceded in 1969 by the Catholic Church, it somehow didn't get out to the public, and I think everyone still sort of considers Mary Magdalene as a fallen woman. And so when this book came out in 82 with these ideas, I thought, this is really interesting. It also covered what's known as the Rennes-le Château mystery. I'm talking about Rennes-le Château, France. And this is a mystery that surrounds a priest, Béranger Chaunier, who was alive at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, late 1800s, early 1900s, in the village of Rennes-le-Château. And at some point, as legend has it, he discovered something that forever changed him, that made him renounce his faith, renounce his church, and in fact call Rome the real heretics, and ended up being excommunicated, but suddenly became fabulously wealthy at the same time. So there's much speculation as to what it was that he found. But in his personal records, there's mention of it that he found a tomb, and through people who knew Saunier, or people whose parents who knew Saunier and passed down the stories, it seems that he had found some sort of a tomb full of treasure. And so we were on the path of Saunier and on the path of the Priory of Zion and on the trail of Jesus and Mary Magdalene when we set out to do this documentary, which actually follows my business partner, Bruce, who's also the director of the film, on his sort of personal investigation into these mysteries. And what we ended up...
You traveled with him throughout all of this film...
I did come back and forth. I mean, it was such a crazy experience, you know, that we had. I mean, that's a whole other story. It's exactly how we did this. We, as you mentioned in your introduction of me, both Bruce and I had been, you know, doing television for years for, you know, networks here and in England and around the world. And Bruce was calling on the other line. He kind of threw me off for a second. He knows I'm on the radio, so I hope everything's fine. But anyway, we had been doing television for a long time, and that's where, you know, a network comes to you with an idea, or you go to them with an idea, and they pay you money, and you go out and produce the film. And that's sort of an easy way to do things in a way, except that you do kind of have to follow along with what it is that they're ordering or that they want you to do. So you don't really have the freedom to just create the product that you want. So this was our first independent feature film, and we decided to do that because we wanted to just dig up the truth, whatever it was, whether it supported these ideas or whether it proved them to be false. We just wanted there to be no pressure from advertisers, from studio heads, from people like that. So we said, we're going to really do this on our own. So we started out, and we found, a company found us that wanted to fund the project, which was great. So we started out great guns, but after we were working for a short period of time, the company that was funding us started to fail in their payments to us, and we had to ultimately terminate with them. And then we were faced with, okay, what are we going to do now? And we said, well, we better just keep going. So what we did was we trimmed down our staff, trimmed down our crew, and just forged ahead. And what that ended up causing is sometimes I would have to come back here or stay in the United States and be raising money and stoking the fire while Bruce was over in France. Now, I did go multiple times and to England as well and other areas to where we were shooting, but there, you know, we were, this went on for a period of over 3 years. So I wasn't there every single moment. But there were a lot of times that you don't see in the film that a lot of times when they were there looking and hadn't found anything. So
well,
a lot of people say
that I have to, one of the things I have to say about the film is obviously this, just the nature of the film, the type of film that it is. You ended up with a lot more questions than we had answers. Are you going to have a sequel to this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In the film, as you know, we uncover a tomb in southern France, which we believe is the Saunier tomb, the same tomb that Saunier found. There's a lot of evidence to support that. But we only had access through a small shaft that was probably created most likely by water dripping down over time. And we were able to thread cameras down, but it's certainly not big enough for a person by any means to get down. So we have to work out how to access that tomb in a way that's not going to cause any damage, because the hole that we're able to shoot through is in the top or the ceiling. It goes down through the ceiling of the tomb. And if we start trying to open that up, it could easily cause, you know, a big collapse and, you know, collapsing onto the tomb and the contents that are inside. We're going to be working with experts, including, you know, the French government's experts and our own experts, to figure out just the best way to open that up and get in without causing any damage.
May I ask you, Renee, what in the world is the French government waiting for? I mean, obviously there is a discovery there. It's so little, I mean, in the traditional media has been said about this potentially mind-blowing find. And here we're still waiting for the French government to do what? I mean, I can't believe that they haven't already started the excavation process.
Well, actually, it's not the French government that is causing any kind of delay. It was, first of all, you know, just we did an initial survey with the French government that needed to be done, and then, you know, we're waiting till the right time for ourselves. It's actually, I don't know how much I want to go into detail, but Ben Hammett, who was actually the original discoverer of the tomb that we hooked up with, Ben had actually discovered the tomb 7 years before we actually got there. And, you know, we want to obviously include Ben in any excavation and examination of the tomb as well. You know, he should be included. And he has a teenage son who's very ill. And so we've been waiting for Ben to get in a position where he can travel, even to be gone for a few days at a time right now. It's just impossible for him. In fact, he was scheduled to come to the premiere in New York, and at the last minute, his son, you know, had some additional problems and he couldn't make it. So he had to have another surgery. In fact, on the day that Bruce and I were flying to New York from Los Angeles, Ben's son was in surgery, so we were quite anxious to get there and get him on the phone once we landed to find out that his son had made it through the surgery all right, and he did. So, but there continues to be problems, and we're waiting for him to get into his good recovery before we go back. Now, we might be waiting for the French government, in that normally in France, everyone takes off July and August. So I would imagine that the DRAC, the agency over archaeological finds in France, will be most likely closed during July and August. So we're looking toward September, October for this excavation to happen.
Do you think that you'll be detailing any of the excavation in another document, in the next documentary?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We plan. We have already had an agreement with the government to film whatever is done during the examination and excavation of the tomb and the analysis, and we'll be putting that and some additional new information and new footage in the second film.
Well, you know, you were talking about Ben Hammett. Ben Hammett, who was the discoverer of the tomb originally, in the movie Bloodline, he was quite nervous before the release of the information. He actually was in fear, literally was in fear for his life. There had been other people that were related to the film on some level that had actually been killed. And I think he had every right, if you saw the film and understood the implications of what was happening, for him to feel that way. Is he feeling less afraid and more secure now that the tomb is out in the public and, you know, just the fact that he is more visual, it's less likely that anybody would wish him harm, I would imagine.
Right, I think so, and I think that's one of the reasons that he wanted to, you know, get the film released, and that's one reason we wanted to go ahead and release what we had, because, you know, basically we've laid everything out on the table that we have so far, and now, you know, there's no way that anyone can, you know, cover it up or keep it from going public, because it's in the public purview now, so we wanted to just make sure that before, you know, someone else happened across it, maybe looted it, or someone tried to shut us down, something like that happened. We wanted to make sure that we got out what we have, you know, to the public so that that couldn't happen. And also so that, you know, once we've shown everything, there's really no use in doing any harm to any of us, including Ben or his family, because there's nothing left to show.
Well, you know, I don't want to skim over the other what we originally started talking about is the way this film was received. Can you tell us where this film was premiered? What cities it's playing in? There's a lot of people that in emails that have been asking us how can they get a hold of the film? Is it out in DVD? Just tell us a little bit of the facts surrounding the film itself and what's going on recently since the premiere.
Great. We premiered the film on May 9th in New York City at the Village East Cinema in Greenwich Village, and it played there for 3 weeks. We were only scheduled to be there for one, and we had some sold-out crowds, so that was really exciting for us. And we did have an incredible response from people, and it was just, as I said, a little overwhelming and very humbling, because we just looked at each other and we were shocked at how people were reacting. And, you know, it was what was interesting to us in particular was that there were people from lots of different backgrounds and beliefs, but they all seemed to sort of come together over this film. And we just had no way of knowing in advance how that was going to go. And not only have we had people, you know, responding well, but people, you know, volunteering to help get the word out, help, you know, with groups and, you know, presentations and amazing things. We've had, you know, people working out, you know, in cities where we're releasing on what we call street teams, you know, handing out postcards and putting up posters, and it's just been really, really wonderful how people have come together and come to help us. I mean, I think they recognize that we're a small production company and that we're putting out as much effort as we can possibly muster on our own. And it's really nice to have people sort of stepping in and supporting us the way that they have. Now, the film is showing currently in Santa Monica here in the Los Angeles area, Santa Monica, at the Monica Fourplex, and this Friday it opens in Santa Ana, California, at the South Coast, at the Regency South Coast Village Cinema, and then next weekend it's opening in Pasadena, California, and I think the next city scheduled is Yelm, Washington, Portland, Oregon, Dallas, Texas, it's all on our website. Anytime we add a new theater listing, it goes up. So on bloodlinethemovie.com, you can get all the latest information on where this film is playing or where it's going to be showing soon. Now, one way that people can see the film or can help to see the film is, and our distributor tells us that this really, really works, is to call your local theater or the theater chain, call the, you know, office and ask them when they're going to be showing the Bloodline documentary. And our distributor tells us that it really causes those theater owners to call. You know, they'll go to the website and they see who the distributor is, and then they'll call and then they order the film. And so this film, I feel like, very much like the film What the Bleep Do We Know, I feel has a real grassroots movement that's growing and growing and growing behind it. I mean, we couldn't be more pleased for that to be the case, because, you know, I always felt like that rather than a big studio film, a big studio release, that this film was always going to be a film for the people. And that I remember telling Bruce, you know, Bruce, we got to take this straight to the people. And I think that that has sort of been borne out in the way that it's growing, and it's growing by word of mouth.
Well, you know, that's very interesting that you should suggest that we call theaters. I had never even thought about that. It's like calling your congressman. Call your theater and ask for Bloodline the movie.
That's right.
You can get more information. The site was bloodlinethemovie.com. Go visit it, and if it isn't playing in your area, I highly recommend the documentary. It is extremely well done. It is entertaining. It is enjoyable. It is thought-provoking. I'll be honest with you, it was probably one of the better of the documentaries that I've seen along the lines of this type of documentary and this type of subject matter. Fred from in our email from Canada has a question, and it mimics mine. I was just going to ask the same thing, Fred. I was going to say, have you encountered any intimidation from the Catholic Church or religious bodies? And my question to that would have been, have you had any feedback from religious organizations such as local dioceses or perhaps even the Vatican in relationship to the film, Renee?
Well, the only overt response or reaction that we've had from the Vatican has been when Bruce, my partner, appeared on Fox and Friends a couple weeks ago. I believe it was on a Sunday morning, and they put him up against Father Jonathan Morris from live, you know, via satellite from the Vatican. And it was kind of interesting because, I mean, I put Bruce up against anybody on this subject matter, including anyone at the Vatican, all the way right up to the Pope. But it was quite amazing at how this priest really lost his cool, and it was funny. His arguments just didn't really make any sense, and it just kind of left one, you know, shaking your head after it was all over. But what was funny was he was telling Bruce at the end, you know, this is dangerous for you to do. You do understand that, don't you, Bruce? Something to that effect. And I remember thinking, well, I wonder what he meant by that. But it was funny because when the cameras were off and Bruce was leaving the set, the cameraman said, did he just threaten you? And we said, well, it could have been taken in a number of ways, so we don't really know. But that was the only response from the Vatican that we've had. At our Q&As at some of the theaters, we've had a couple of confrontations. So I wouldn't call them terrible confrontations from people who, you know, brought their Bibles to the film and felt it necessary to stand up in the back of the auditorium. Thank goodness they didn't do it during the film, but during our Q&As, and started sort of doing their own little sermon. But what was interesting was the theater audience kind of cooled those people down real quickly and made it known that, you know, they were interrupting what was going on, and it wasn't really welcome. So, and Bruce is very good at handling those kinds of situations.
He
just said, you know, hey, we're happy to talk to you. Meet us out in the lobby after the film, after we're finished with our Q&A. I'm happy to discuss this with you. And he did. And it seemed to kind of diffuse the situation. So we haven't had a lot of terrible things. We've had more things said about us on the internet, you know, by some groups, you know, more of the sort of fundamentalist type groups, and, you know, mention of the Antichrist and, you know, calling the film blasphemous and that sort of thing. And but other than that, it's been mostly positive.
Which is really interesting, because the film itself actually just showed a majority of the archaeological find of the tomb, and the belief is that this is the tomb of one of the Knights Templars. At least that is the speculation. Now, whether it is or not, nobody really knows, and I guess we won't know until the excavation and the archaeological dig actually starts. For those of you interested in talking to Renee, you can call us toll-free at 877-489-6350 or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. The numbers again are 877-489-6350 and 888-228-4494. You can also visit us on our website and read more about Renee and the movie The Bloodline. And you can go back on our iPod Ready podcast and listen to the last program when both her and Bruce were together discussing the upcoming premiere of the film. We have an email question from one of our listeners, and that is Sue from Massachusetts, and it's more almost of a suggestion, Renee. Have you thought of getting in touch with Rudolf Gottenbrink, the gentleman who devised the robot to explore the shafts of the Great Pyramid of Giza? It would provide you with access without destruction, which is an excellent idea. You may want to bring that up at a later date when this becomes pertinent.
Right. You know, that is a fantastic idea. You know, at the time, you know, when we were doing the original investigation, we just didn't have a lot of resources at hand, but we will have more when we go back. We will have more experts on board. The thing about that is, though, that would still be a robotic camera or some sort of a robot to go in, but we need to open that up so that we can actually take things out to be analyzed. And for instance, you know, there's a mummified corpse in there, and I'm sure that will be analyzed. And we've only managed to take a couple of hairs that had already fallen off, and we were able to grab those. But that's it. That's the only analysis that we've been able to do on that body at all. And we were able to only get, because of the degraded state of the hair, we were only able to get mitochondrial DNA, and which gives you a very limited amount of information, only really, you know, a haplogroup profile. In this case, it was a Middle Eastern profile, fairly unique or fairly rare in Europe, occurring at a rate of about 4%. So we thought that was interesting. It certainly wouldn't rule out, if it were someone in, you know, the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, it certainly wouldn't rule that out, the fact that they had some Middle Eastern descent. However, as you said, we just don't know who that is yet. You know, Ben thinks it's Mary Magdalene because of the way that the hands are posed. The fingers are interlaced exactly as they are in an altar painting in the church there at Rennes-le-Château that was actually done by the priest and left people feel as a clue. There are also some other paintings. I think there's a Poussin painting of Mary Magdalene in which her fingers are interlaced in that same way.
Yes, very interesting. Well, we're going to take a short break right now and come right back because we have a lot more questions. This is just a fascinating topic. And again, if you want to call and talk to Renee, 877-489-6350 and 888-228-4494, or you can contact us through email. Thank you. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
This Join us on the People Speak radio show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for sticking around and being with us tonight. Our guest, Renee Barnett, producer of the film documentary Bloodline, along with director Bruce Burgess. And thank you for coming, for being with us this evening, Renee. Renee, I'd like to ask you something here, and I think it's first of all, you know, we've talked about the reception of the film. There was a documentary, it was an HBO documentary by a comedian, his name was Robert Wool, and the documentary was called Assume the Position. It cited a scene in the film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and the autobiographer said to the late Jimmy Stewart, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. I found that people actually prefer not only to print the legend, but they prefer to believe the legend in light of the world's religions and faux politics. What do you think about society hanging on to pre-existing ideologies and beliefs, even in light of such tremendous and profound information? Now, obviously, the tomb itself has not been determined what it is, but there have been implications throughout history that this is things weren't what we, but why is it that we want to believe so deeply?
Well, I think that we're all, you know, more or less, you know, some more than others, products of our own programming, are, you know, depending on where we grew up, depending on what our family life was like, depending on, you know, who our teachers were, depending on what church we went to or didn't go to. I think, you know, people are a product of programming, and I think it's also kind of a natural inclination of people to want to be led, want to have a leader, want to, you know, it sort of takes the responsibility away from you. I mean, if suddenly, you know, everyone realizes that, you know, we don't need, an intercessor between us and God, or us and the source, however you want to believe, then that puts the onus back on us. You know, as long as we're just hopeless sinners and, you know, born evil, and we can never hope to achieve, you know, what Jesus did or any of the other great masters. You know, we can't possibly achieve that because we're not divine. I think that takes a lot of responsibility off of us. And in a way, it's kind of a laziness. But also, I think people just generally, you know, they believe what they've been told all their lives long. And it's difficult. I remember when I first, I was in the Southern Baptist Church in rural Oklahoma. And I remember when I first read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, with these ideas that Jesus could be Mary, that Mary Magdalene, maybe she was somehow more important than we had been led to believe, and all these other heretical ideas. I remember feeling kind of guiltily, you know, some guilty pleasure at reading those things, thinking, oh my goodness, am I going to go straight to hell because I'm even entertaining these thoughts? But yet I found them intriguing, and then, but moreover, I found them, you know, plausible. It sounded more likely to me to be something that would be true. And then later, knowing more about earlier religion, knowing that, you know, Jesus as a Jewish rabbi at that time would have certainly almost positively been married. It would have been very unusual for him not to have been married, and quite strange, and would certainly have been mentioned in the text, because the normal way for a rabbi to live was to be married. So it would have been something of note.
Even today in the Middle, even today in the Middle East, and I can vouch for that as a middle, ethnically a Middle Easterner, it would be totally out of the out of character for a 33-year-old male not to be married. I can tell you that, and that's happening now. I can't even imagine 2,000 years ago.
Exactly.
So I have to agree with you on that. We have a caller on line two, Mike from California. Mike, you have a question for Renee?
Yes. Hello, Renee. Thank you for coming on the show. It's very
Hi.
Good. It's very exciting. My question is, are you guys really working on giving this discovery some kind of scientific validation? Will there be, will it be published, the results and the findings in some peer-reviewed scientific journal? Will there be other scientists, et cetera, on site during the excavation to... And have you invited anybody from the Catholic Church to be on site?
I have not invited anyone from the Catholic Church to be on site. However, we've talked to many experts, and I also would imagine that the French government, who will be, you know, will be doing this in cooperation with, will have experts of their own. But certainly, we're already gearing up and bringing on experts, and we've had a couple of universities contact us and offer help and, you know, equipment and testing and personnel. So that's exciting. And as well as the DNA laboratory that we used in Ontario, Canada, at the it's the Paleo DNA lab in Thunder Bay. It's Lakehead University, by the way. And they definitely want to be involved. And they said, you know, first thing we're going to do when you get that thing open is we're going to don the white suits, and we're going to go in there, and we're going to collect everything that we need to collect before anybody touches anything. And so, yes, we are planning on having experts involved, and those have not been finalized yet. And also, as I said, I'm sure the French government will have, they'll certainly have their expert spaleos, their cavers, as well as other, I would imagine, people that are going to be performing some of the analysis.
So you don't know if any of the local museums are going to be involved in the excavation at all?
No, I don't know. It's possible. It's possible that the Carcassonne Museum might be called in, but that wouldn't be up to us. That would be up to the French government.
Okay, I see.
But as for any peer reviews, I would imagine that there would be something, especially if some of these universities are on board with us and, you know, their archaeology departments and that sort of thing. Again, that's sort of not, you know, our bailiwick. So we'll be standing back a little bit this time and allowing the real experts to go in and make their findings.
Any of the experts that were actually in the first documentary, Bloodline, are they going to be involved in any of this?
I would imagine Dr. Gabriel Barkai will be involved, you know, depending on his schedule and the timing of the examination and all that. But I'm certain that we would have him checking in on some of the items that we would find. In the film, there was some earlier footage that was taken originally by Ben Hammett when he first discovered the tomb, and then there's some later footage that we took, you know, when we went back with Ben. But in the original footage, you can actually see that there are scrolls laying around inside the tomb. And then in the new footage, you can also see that there's a big book that's in there. You know, certainly the scrolls would be something we probably have Dr. Barkai take a look at. If they appear to be ancient, that's his, you know, his area of expertise. And but it depends on what we find. There may be experts that are called in as we go because of what we're finding. And, you know, there'll be certain people that, for instance, if that book turns out to be written in Old French, you know, then we'll have an Old French expert examining that. You know, it just depends on what we find, who ultimately gets called in. But we'll certainly have a team going in.
We have an email question from Janet in Ohio that's very interesting. And Janet asks, who do the artifacts belong to from the tomb, and can anyone claiming to be part of the bloodline claim ownership?
Well, the answer to the first question is who owns the artifacts is they belong to the French government. The way that it works is, if the artifacts are sold, for instance, if they're sold to a museum, then the discoverer of the tomb of the artifacts is entitled to 50%, and the owner of the land where they were discovered is entitled to 50%. In this case, the owner of the property is the French government. It's on French government land, and the discoverer is Ben Hammett. So if those items are ever sold, then he's entitled to 50% of that. Kind of think that's, you know, more likely that they would probably loan them to a museum rather than sell them. So there may never be any proceeds from those items. And as to the second part of the question about could someone in the bloodline make a claim, I would imagine anybody could raise a claim, but you know, we still don't know who that is in the tomb and who these items, you know, originally belonged to. There may be some evidence, you know, that we uncover when we're able to fully examine everything and analyze the body and the scrolls, the book, other things inside the tomb. Maybe will give us some clue as to who the original owner was. And then it's possible that whatever that family is might have some sort of claim. I'm not sure. Since we don't know who it really is.
I would imagine that there could obviously be some historical claims that would come up. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to, you know, the media is always asking about the opposing opinions on particular films. And I'm interested in, as the film and as the subject matter, what were some of the questions that supporters of this type of subject matter felt like and talked about to you about the film itself, Renee? I mean, do you think that this came out at a good time?
I think it's come out at the right time, just because I don't know if you remember in the film when Nicholas Haywood of the Priory of Zion representative says, you know, the Priory always says that things are always unfolding according to plan, because they always are. And we wanted this film out a long time ago. We would have finished this film had we been according to schedule, had we not had our money troubles and our budget problems and our financial failures. We would have had this film out 2 years before it was actually released. But had we done that, had we released it after a year, we had not yet found the chest with the Jerusalemite relics from first century, we would not have found the tomb. We would not have met Ben Hammett. So it would have been a much different film with much less actual hard evidence. Mostly, it would have mostly been anecdotal, which has sort of been, you know, in my opinion, what's already been out there is, you know, lots of anecdotal evidence, but very little hard evidence. And so we wouldn't have had any of the things that we had if things had gone right, and that's in quotes.
Exactly. Let me ask you, you know, the people that witnessed it, you said that a lot of people were coming up, giving all of the support to you, offering help in promoting the film. Why? Why do you think it touched them?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's hard for me to speak for other people, but it just seemed to touch people on a deep spiritual level, which, you know, as I said, you know, although we felt we were on almost a spiritual initiation path of some kind because of the way things turned out and the way that we ended up having to proceed, and the way that the Priory was dealing with us, you know, just giving us bits of information, but yet we had to work out everything else on our own, and it was very difficult. I'm not sure exactly how, you know, how to speak for other people, and I think maybe it's touching people in different ways. I know with a lot of women, it has, and with myself, it's touched in a way that it's sort of like by elevating Mary Magdalene to her rightful place in history, it feels like, you know, we're doing something to elevate all of womankind. And I'm not saying we're, as in Bruce and I, are doing it, but I'm just saying if Mary Magdalene is restored to her rightful place, I believe that it does something to sort of lift up all women everywhere. And not only that, but help restore balance, to the world that's so desperately needed, because we've been living in a very, you know, male-oriented world, and we love the men and we love the male energy, but
well,
without the balance,
it's all upset here.
We need that balance going, you know, which is what we really haven't had. I think that, you know, that there's, you know, a lot of warrior energy out there, and not quite enough, you know, nurturing and spiritual energy, which I think we would get if we, you know, raise that divine feminine back up where she's supposed to be.
Mm. And I find it interesting the way you put it. You said elevated Mary Magdalene to her rightful place, and not demoting Jesus Christ from his place, I think, which is a very,
oh,
very
absolutely
interesting way of putting it. Thank you. John from Nevada asks, what in the tomb would be irrefutable evidence of Jesus and or Mary Magdalene's presence in Europe?
Oh, my goodness. That is such an amazing question, one which I don't know if I can answer at all. I mean, we've thought about that ourselves, because Nicholas Haywood in the Priory of Zion said that there is incontrovertible proof, proof that is unquestionable. Now, I don't know if that proof lies in this particular tomb or whether it's somewhere else, but we've tried to figure out just what would constitute incontrovertible proof, unless there was something really unusual about a body. I mean, even if there's a name tag, you know, that says, here lies Jesus or here lies Mary Magdalene, it still could have been put there by somebody else. You know, it's still
right.
Not incontrovertible proof.
Right.
You know, if those scrolls, if that book are some sort of records or genealogies, it still isn't proof. It's evidence, but it's not proof. So I'm not sure what would be proof, unless it's something absolutely amazing and supernatural, you know, to the extent that, you know, no one can question that something really unusual is there. But I just don't know what that would be. I wish I knew.
Because the representative, Nicholas Haywood of the Priory of Sion, seemed to allude that it was irrefutable evidence. And
yes.
I wonder how he, I mean, obviously, if anybody that has seen the film, this representative of the Priory was very mysterious. I can't think of a better word to describe, because he really didn't offer much information, and when he responded to Bruce's questions, they were vague and somewhat ambiguous. But at the same time, he gave you enough to know that whatever it is, it was big, and this is not going to be refuted. And I found that to be very, very telling. Now, did Nicholas or the Priory of Sion have any comments after the movie, and have they seen the film?
No, Nicholas has not seen the film. I have been in communication with him up until, you know, as recently as about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I know after the film did come out, it made front page headlines in the London papers because of a particular part of the film where we talk about some mysterious deaths, including the death of Lord Patrick Lichfield while we were filming. So because Lord Lichfield was the Queen's cousin, it made, you know, that country's headlines, because there was a suggestion that members of the Priory had been murdered by means of a certain poison, which causes symptoms that seem to be a cerebral hemorrhage or stroke, that mimic a cerebral hemorrhage or stroke, or indeed cause a cerebral hemorrhage or stroke. And so after that happened, I did hear from Nick, and he was getting some phone taps and having some problems, he said. So he went out and bought a disposable telephone that he instructed me to use when I contacted him, and he said, you know, he would just keep it for a temporary period and then toss it away. So I know he's had some, I'm not sure if he's had threats, but I know he's had at least indications that someone's been sort of looking in on him that, you know, he wasn't quite comfortable with. So, but that's all I know.
Very interesting. Is the film available in DVD yet?
No, it's not. Normally what happens when a film is released theatrically is it does its theatrical run, and usually around 4 months' time, and then the film will generally then come out on DVD. And our distributor is busy marketing it worldwide right now to not only theaters and worldwide television, but also to DVD markets and distributors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we'll be also having it available at some point, at the earliest possible time, on our website.
Oh, that would be wonderful, too. I'm surprised that it hasn't been uploaded on YouTube thus far.
Oh, I hope that doesn't happen.
I hope
not yet
either. Because I'll be honest with you, I really would like to see this in a theater setting. I think that it adds a great deal.
It really does.
It does.
It really does.
There's nothing like big theater.
When we, just before we released it theatrically, we had never seen it on the big screen. And so one day, here in Los Angeles, there are theaters that you can rent, you know. And so one afternoon, Bruce and I went and rented a theater and watched our film in a big theater auditorium. Just we were the only two members of the audience. But it really blew us away. It was a different experience seeing it on the big screen. It really was amazing. And, of course, you can see so much more, and, you know, especially in terms of the tomb and other things like that. But it sort of also does a better job of sort of taking you along with it when it's on the big screen. It just kind of envelops you, and you go right along on the journey.
We have another question from Elaine in Missouri in our email, and this is kind of an interesting. We've only got probably about three more minutes. Elaine asks, if your discovery proves to be authentic and seems to validate the idea that Jesus and Mary were married, do you think it will affect the Christian belief in his divinity?
I think what it might do is it might make people wonder and possibly question and look into and then decide for themselves whether if the truth wasn't told about Jesus and Mary Magdalene, you know, might there be other things that haven't been quite quite told in the right way? You know, and somebody said something to us recently about, you know, it's not that Jesus was not divine, but what it's done is it's robbed us of our own divinity, and that, you know, that in possibly Jesus's real ministry, and, you know, he's been known to, or at least have said to have said, you know, even greater things than these shall ye do, and he also said, ye are gods. So what did he mean by those things? You know, I don't think he was the one that was going around saying you're a hopeless sinner and you can never be like me. So, you know, why try? But, yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. I hope it sparks lots of debate.
Well, it certainly, as far as I'm concerned, should spark a lot of debate. I think that, but of course, I'm going to reserve a lot of my decision based on the outcome of the findings of this incredible archaeological tomb that has been discovered in France. I think that if nothing more, it will open, drop the veil of mystery around a certain number of things that I think shouldn't be mysterious. I think mystery is kind of overrated when it comes to certain of the dogmatic practices. I want to thank you tremendously, Renee, for being with us this evening. I've been following this. I think it's wonderful. I'm going to certainly promote it. And like we said, go to your movie theaters and ask for the movie. I thought that was a great idea. I mean, you know, in so many ways we are politically involved, and here we never really think to ask and demand the kind of entertainment that we want.
That's right.
That's an excellent idea. I love that. Good luck. Good luck to Bruce. Please give him our best. Let him know that we will be sending him good energy for him and for the recovery of his brother. We are going to end this for tonight. And Thursday night, we have a special show this Thursday. Vincent Bugliosi, who is the author of the Prosecution of Bush for Murder, will be with us Thursday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. We also are going to be having on Wednesday, tomorrow night, with our host David Swanson. David will be doing both interviews. Byron DeLeer, who is running for the U.S. House of Representatives, and he is seeking the Democratic nomination for Missouri's 2nd Congressional District in 208. It's going to be a great couple of shows. Renee, I really, really appreciate this. I go to www.bloodlinethemovie.com. There I also asked Renee, there is a link where you can watch the debate between the priest and Bruce Burgess, the director of the film, and some of the other television things. So there's a lot of wonderful things on this site. Please visit the site. And it's a great movie. If nothing more, it'll certainly keep your mind moving in certain directions. Thank you very much, Renee. Good luck to you, and I will be keeping tabs on this.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good to be back.
You be well. We'll talk to you another time, I hope. And we certainly will have you back when the next film comes out.
Oh, yes. Thanks, Fatima.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Renee.
Bye-bye.
That's it, folks. Thank you very much, and we'll see you tomorrow night with David Swanson and our guests. Bye-bye, everybody.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief confessed as summer people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water.
Yeah. Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.